Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The Food and Drug Administration today broadened its warning to a nationwide level. We're advising consumers, says the warning, not to use extra strength Tylenol until a series of deaths in the Chicago area can be clarified.
The phone has been ringing off the hook at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center in Chicago.
We've been receiving calls about once every 15 seconds. At the Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's, we only have three poison lines, and they're lit up constantly ever since yesterday morning.
That was more than three decades ago in Chicago. Seven people mysteriously died in what was later found out to be poisoning from Tylenol that had been laced with cyanide. Despite all the media coverage it received at the time, the incident today is not often remembered. But a new podcast about drugs and medicine produced by KERA with support from NPR tells the full story. We're joined now by one of the co-hosts of that podcast. Lauren Silverman is a health, science, and technology reporter with KERA News in Dallas. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Lauren, why did you guys decide to focus on the story of Tylenol cyanide poisoning that happened mostly in Chicago, which was interesting for me because I kind of vaguely remembered this as a kid, but I didn't even know that it happened here in Illinois.
Yeah. Well, at the time, it became a national, even an international story. But really, in this podcast, what we want to do is answer a pretty simple question, which is, what's in your medicine cabinet? So what is the story behind the pills in there? And a lot of us inside our medicine cabinets have Tylenol. And there's this really crazy story behind Tylenol that most of us, especially who are younger, don't really know or maybe have only vaguely heard about. And it was one of the first cases, some people say, of domestic terrorism in the U.S., and it reshaped the way we take pills today, the way all of us take pills.
So before we get to that, let's talk about the story. You all opened the podcast, and it's such a heartbreaking explanation about a newlywed couple who dies suddenly in their home. What happened?
Yeah, it's really a sad story. And what started everything off was the death of a 12-year-old girl, actually, Mary Kellerman, who went into her bathroom to take some Tylenol because she was staying home from school one day. She had felt sick. And she collapsed in there. Her father found her, and she was dead. And there were a number of these cases happening in and around Chicago that same day. But it seemed random. There was nothing linking them together, and it wasn't that suspicious until three people all in the same house collapsed. And these three people were, two was a young couple who'd recently been married and a brother. And first, what happened was that one of the brothers, Adam, who was a postal worker, he dropped and collapsed dead in his house. And all of the family, this is a big Polish family, so they're all getting together for the funeral there, gathering. And his brother, Stanley, and his new wife, Teresa, were also at the house in mourning. While they were there, they didn't feel so well, and they decided to take some Tylenol. And they happened to take Tylenol from the same bottle that Stanley, who had died earlier that day, had taken it from. And both of them suddenly collapsed and were taken. Well, one was pronounced dead. Stanley was pronounced dead. And Teresa was taken to the hospital. So it seems suspicious that three people all collapsed same day, and they couldn't figure out why. They were all young,
right,
and
young, healthy people. And so it is fascinating. You all go back into, in this podcast, you talk to the former medical examiner. How did he make the connection, and how did he come to the idea that all of these people had died from cyanide poisoning?
Yeah, at first he didn't know what was going on, and he wasn't even supposed to be at work when he heard about this. But he started to come up with possible ideas. First, he investigated different types of poisonings, but one of the types of poisonings that could do something like this, besides carbon monoxide, was cyanide. And he knew that cyanide has a particular smell, which I had no idea about this. But Sima Yasmin, the co-host, she was familiar with this because she's actually a doctor. But cyanide has a smell. And so while there were some investigators on the scene in the houses where people had dropped dead, Donahue, who is the medical examiner, he asks one of the investigators over the phone to smell the bottle of Tylenol. And he smells it, and he can smell something that's sort of like bitter almonds. And that's the smell of cyanide. So he knew then he had a lead, and he started looking in their bodies for the traces of cyanide and was able to find that.
And so this leads to, we were playing some of the media clips from this. At the time, this was probably one of the biggest stories of 1982 when this happens, right? Like, this becomes an international story. It leads to an unprecedented. Mayor Jane Byrne at the time, does she actually ban Tylenol from Chicago? Everybody, what happens?
Yeah, I mean, imagine it. This is something that is in everyone's medicine cabinets, and it's something that people trust so much. So the very thought that a pill you turn to for a headache could kill you was terrifying. And beyond that, no one knew if it was in other products, if it was in something in the fridge, if it was in something on other aisles in the stores. So there was so much panic and so much fear that Mayor Jane Byrne was put in this position where she wasn't sure, of course, what to do. And she ended up banning Tylenol in the city, and there were police with their sirens on going throughout the city, warning people not to take Tylenol, telling them to throw away or turn in any bottles of Tylenol. So it was a really extreme case.
And so it ends up, and I know there's this great detail in the podcast about how they're printing pamphlets in all these different languages and distributing them all over Chicago saying, don't take Tylenol. This leads to a recall of 31 million bottles of Tylenol. And it also led to some pretty major changes in the FDA in the way pills are packaged, right?
Yeah. A little bit later, there was a law that was passed, the Anti-Tampering Act, and that made it a federal crime to actually tamper with medicine. It wasn't a federal crime beforehand because nothing like this had ever happened, so it didn't occur to them. It also made it so that pharmaceutical companies needed to package things like this over the counter in blister packs or with safety seals so that it would prevent people from tampering with medication.
And I imagine this was for Johnson & Johnson, the parent company of Tylenol. This is sort of a complete, I don't want to say it is a complete PR disaster, right? I mean, in terms of having a product that's, as you said, everyone sees as a safety, as a first aid, as something that helps you, turns out to be so harmful. How did they handle all of this?
Well, what's funny is that marketing experts predicted that Tylenol would be the doom of Johnson & Johnson, that it would spell disaster, that they wouldn't be able to recover. At the time, they relied on sales of Tylenol. I think that they had one of every $5 that the company was making came from selling Tylenol, and it had 37% of the market share for over-the-counter painkillers. So once the news of these cyanide-laced pills got out, that flipped. The company's market share dropped from 37% to 7%. So they had to come up with a public relations campaign to convince people to trust Tylenol again. And they did this very effectively, in large part by acting quickly to come up with commercials and ads that built trust in the company. So they had people like firefighters saying why they still took Tylenol, people who were mothers saying why they still took Tylenol, these sort of testimonials to get people back on board with the company. And they were able to turn the image around. And as you hear when my co-host Seema Yasmin asks young people today what they think of when they think of Tylenol, most people don't say cyanide.
And then the other part of this, Lauren, I'm not sure how old you are, but the other kind of incident that I have this sort of vague memory as a kid of remembering this, but also the big thing I remember is Halloween candy. And I remember as a child, my parents saying that they had to like check all of my Halloween candy before we ate it. And I have like this very clear memory of my dad like spreading out all the candy, you know, sort of like your ritual, right? My sisters and I would like sort the candy because then we would
dump
start
out
trading
the
candy. Right. And then we did like, but before we commenced trading and all of that other stuff, my dad would have to check the candy. And I remember I have this vague memory of it being because of this.
Yeah. So I had no idea that there were this many copycat cases. There were something like 270 confirmed copycat cases that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration reported. And these were pills tainted with everything from rat poison to hydrochloric acid. So there was also, though, copycats, like you're saying, who decided to tamper with food, hot dogs, Halloween candy. And it's something that still echoes today in Halloween's of modern times.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess part of this is also the thing that was also very surprising to me about this was you all were able to, you know, we were talking about Teresa, who was one of the three family members who died. You were actually able to speak to her brother about everything. I imagine because it's been three decades, maybe he was more willing to talk about what had happened.
Yeah. You know what's funny is when I first spoke to him, he was hesitant to talk about it, which I can only imagine why. Most of the family members of victims of this don't want to talk about it, and they're tired of having people call them on anniversaries of the murders and asking them what's happened
tough, right?
since. But I told him we weren't just going to do an anniversary piece. We really wanted to look at how this reshaped pills and medicine, and also talk about the case study that Johnson & Johnson has become in terms of this model for how a corporation should handle public relations crises. And that's what the 1982 Tylenol murders has become. It's become a case study for business school students. And that bothers people like Bob, people like Bob Tarasevich, because they don't feel like Johnson & Johnson behaved as well as everyone seems to in the rest of the country. He sees it as, in some ways, a failure on their part.
Right. And there's all these kind of conspiracy theories about, was it someone who did this in the store? Was this something that happened in the factory? Was this something that was Johnson & Johnson's fault? And I wanted to play another portion of the podcast where you and co-host Sina Yasmin talk about how these murders are still unsolved.
The FBI considers the Tylenol murders of 1982 an open and active investigation, and we have not arrested or convicted a suspect for this crime.
That's Garrett Kroon, an FBI agent in Chicago, who says, make no mistake, they have not solved this case yet.
Motives were explored, people were explored, sightings were explored.
And this is the former prosecutor, Jeremy Margolis, who said, it's not that they weren't working tirelessly to pursue every lead.
Lookalikes, photographs, musings of people who would call in on hotlines were explored.
But everything fizzled out.
That's a piece from a podcast we're talking about right now. It's about the Tylenol murders. Co-host Lauren Silverman from KERA in Dallas is with me on the line right now. So the Illinois police are still actively working on this, Lauren?
Yes, they're the ones who are on the case, although I don't know how actively they're
actually working. It's still open, right? It's still an open case.
It's still open, mm-hmm. Exactly. And because it's still open, it means that no one in the public can access any of the files related to the investigation. And that's one of the big complaints of some of the family members of the victims, because they want to see, well, what actually happened in this investigation? And how do you know it was really some madman who went into stores and took down bottles of Tylenol and put capsules filled with cyanide back in those bottles, and that's really what happened?
Yeah, and that's why we have all of those anti-tampering, like the foil labels and all of that stuff. That's why that all exists today, right?
Exactly. It's all a result of the 1982 Tylenol murders. And I was thinking about it, and I can't think of that many products that were shaped by murder. I always think of products that have been shaped to prevent accidents, which is what I originally thought safety seals were for, were to prevent accidents. But the story behind it is much more grim, and something that some people are reminded of every time they open up a bottle of Tylenol.
Right. Yeah, especially for these families. Well, if you want to hear more about this, you can check out this new podcast. It's about drugs and medicine. Not yet named, right, Lauren? But we will tweet out the link to it, and so everyone can see it. We found it on NPR One. We will send out that link to everyone if you follow our handle, 21st Show. We'll also put it up at our website at 21stshow.org. But I really want to thank Lauren Silverman, who is a health, science, and technology reporter and one of the co-hosts of this new podcast about drugs. She's with KERA News in Dallas. Hey, Lauren, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us about all of this.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Natasha Trethewey is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. She's also the former poet laureate of the United States and a Southerner. She was born to a white father and a black mother in Mississippi. Interracial marriage was still illegal when her parents got married. She started writing poetry in college from 2012 to 2014. She served as the Poet Laureate of the United States. She's also the author of four collections of poetry and a creative nonfiction book about Hurricane Katrina. Her writing explores memory, race, and the lives of people forgotten by history. She's currently a professor of English and creative writing at Emory University. Natasha, welcome to The 21st. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
When did you first start writing poetry?
Well, I wrote poetry like a lot of people as a kid. I think I wrote my first poems when I was in the third grade, and I had a third grade teacher and librarian who bound that collection of poems and put them in our library, and I felt very much like a poet. But I began writing poems seriously again in graduate school. I thought I was going to be a fiction writer when I went to graduate school, but I quickly learned that I was indeed a poet.
And so much of your poetry focuses on being interracial, and I wanted to ask you about your parents' marriage. So your parents got married, and it was actually illegal. They couldn't get married in Mississippi because they were an interracial couple.
That's right. I tend to write a lot about history, and certainly in writing about history and the history of the United States, race is there because race is woven into the very fabric of our country, and I write about it to the extent that it is American. But I do also investigate my own personal history, and some of that history is about my parents' interracial marriage being biracial. They met at Kentucky State College, which is one of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities. My mother went there as a black woman from Mississippi. My father, who came down from Canada, went there because when he got out a guide to American colleges and universities, he discovered that it was one that he could afford without realizing that it was a black college. And he ended up there and met my mother. They first tried to get married in Frankfort, Kentucky, and were turned away. And they had to cross.
What year was this?
That was 1965.
Wow.
So they
not
crossed the river.
Not long ago at all.
No, not when you think about it. When you think that we are now in 2017 about to celebrate the Loving versus the State of Virginia decision that finally ruled that those anti-miscegenation laws were unconstitutional.
So they had to cross the river, you were saying?
They crossed the Ohio River into Cincinnati and got married there.
And so when you were a child, were you aware of all of this? Was this something that was, I imagine it's not something that parents would probably discuss with their kids.
I had the kind of parents that would discuss it. Okay. And it's hard to live in Mississippi and not know what's going on because people glared at us, yelled things at us, burned a cross in the yard. Mm. It was easy to know at a very young age.
And how did they explain everything to you? How did they talk about it?
You know, I think that they said the kinds of things that I imagine a lot of parents in interracial marriages tell their children, that you have the best of both worlds. It's a very, you know, happy message of, you know, cultural blending. And but they also were very open and honest about talking about racism in America and the kinds of things that we would face because we were a blended family.
How much of that you think is an important part of your poetry now? You mentioned something about American history. Mm-hmm. I think there's so much of Black history that I think is not taught as part of American history. I think we're learning so much more. As someone who grew up in the South, mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot I didn't learn. Mm-hmm. As someone who had a Southern, and you know, growing up in Florida, there was a lot I did not learn about Florida and Florida's racist history until mm-hmm. I was an adult, actually living in the Midwest, and reading things like Isabel Wilkerson's, you know, The Great Might, reading things about, learning a lot about what it was like. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of, and I think so much of your work is about sort of providing that voice, providing a lens to people who are forgotten. How do you go about doing that?
Well, in my third collection, Native Guard, one of the things that I wrote about was the history of Black participation in the Civil War. The historian Eric Foner points out that of the hundreds of Civil War monuments, North and South, only a handful mention anything about Black soldiers, even as nearly 200,000 of them fought in the Civil War. Now, I am from the Mississippi Gulf Coast, a little town called Gulfport, and just off the coast of Gulfport is a fort called Fort Massachusetts, which is where the Louisiana Native Guards were stationed. The Louisiana Native Guards were among the first regiments of African-American Union soldiers mustered into service in the Civil War. And if you take the tour of the fort, as I did on the 4th of July, every year, there's no mention of the Black soldiers there. It was one of these histories that was sort of erased or forgotten or buried. And so I started trying to uncover and tell the story of those Black soldiers, which, of course, is an American story. It is deeply American. And now things have changed out on Ship Island. There's a plaque on the mainland before you go out there recognizing this history that belongs to all Americans.
So you said things have changed. What role do you think poetry can play and help uncover this, right? Because it's interesting that you're in this realm as a poet. I think a lot of people would think, oh, this is what historians should do, mm-hmm. or this is what, and I think poetry is a form of education, but mm-hmm. I think people would think this is something teachers should be doing or historians should be
doing. Well, of course, professional historians are the ones who've been working on these issues forever. I mean, I turn to the work of professional historians in order to animate the characters I invent for poems. And yet, perhaps too few people read the interesting work of professional historians like I do.
Right.
But there is a way that poetry can reach a different kind of audience, just as all art can reach different kinds of audiences. And so the people who were working to get a monument erected, some kind of historical marker erected on the Gulf Coast, were thrilled and welcoming me to the struggle, in a sense, because of the attention that the book got as a book of poems. All of a sudden, more people know about it than might have known about it. And so we have to kind of pool the resources of historians and playwrights and poets and teachers to tell those stories.
I'm speaking with Natasha Trethewey. We're talking about her poetry. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, former poet laureate of the United States. And as you're talking about those characters, I wonder how when you're sort of doing research, do you just put yourself in that world? How do you come up with these characters? Is it something where you're sort of imagining all of their lives and then you're writing poetry about them? Mm-hmm. What's that process like for you?
Well, I spend a good bit of time in the archives trying to read the letters that people who were stationed on the island would have kept, or reading diaries, reading newspaper accounts, traveling to the places to interact with the weather, with the climate, to imagine what their lives might have been like in a particular place. But I rely heavily on documentary evidence.
So I would love it. Would you mind reading something from this? Is your third book, Native Guard?
Mm-hmm. This is a poem about taking one of those journeys on the boat out to Ship Island. It has an epigraph from Alan Tate that reads, "Now that the salt of their blood stiffens the saltier oblivion of the sea." Elegy for the Native Guards. We leave Gulfport at noon, gulls overhead trailing the boat, streamers, noisy fanfare, all the way to Ship Island. What we see first is the fort, its roof of grass alee, half reminder of the men who served there, a weathered monument to some of the dead. Inside we follow the ranger, hurried though we are to get to the beach. He tells of graves lost in the gulf, the island split in half when Hurricane Camille hit, shows us casemates, cannons, the store that sells souvenirs, tokens of history long buried. The Daughters of the Confederacy has placed a plaque here at the fort's entrance, each Confederate soldier's name raised hard in bronze. No names carved for the Native Guards, 2nd Regiment, Union men, Black Phalanx. What is monument to their legacy? All the grave markers, all the crude headstones, water lost. Now fish dart among their bones, and we listen for what the waves intone. Only the fort remains, near 40 feet high, round, unfinished, half open to the sky, the elements, wind, rain, God's deliberate eye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like it's hard to follow that up with a question, but I did want to ask, how do you decide? Like, how do you decide which historical lives, or how do you decide which moments how to capture in a poem?
You know, the poet Mark Doty says, our metaphors go on ahead of us. So when I started writing about the Native Guards, I knew that I was just interested in this history that I hadn't known about, that hadn't been properly memorialized or inscribed on the landscape and the landscape of our cultural imagination. And at the same time, I was coming to the point in which I'd lived as many years with my mother as without her. She was killed when I was 19. And I began writing elegies for her, to try to remember her, or even to bring her back in the way that the language of a poem can, if only for a brief moment. What I didn't know is what my mother had in common with those Black soldiers, and I found it out only because I was working on a poem called Graveyard Blues. I'd been jogging in the graveyard one morning near my house, and there's a Confederate part of the cemetery, and I couldn't get past each of the headstones without stopping to read their names. It was as if they were demanding to be remembered. So I went home and I thought, well, I'm going to write a poem about these Confederate soldiers. But what came out was a poem about the day we buried my mother. And the last two lines of the poem read, I wander now among names of the dead, my mother's name, stone pillow for my head. And the idea in those last lines is that if you were missing someone and grieving, you could go to the cemetery and lay your head on their stone and feel a kind of cold comfort in the hardness of the stone. And I knew that it was emotionally true when I wrote it, but it wasn't factually true. All those years, nearly 25 years later, I'd never put a stone on my mother's grave. She lay in the ground unmarked and unremembered, like those soldiers. And I realized that it had been my duty to remember her, just as it is our duty as Americans to remember and to memorialize and to erect monuments to these Black soldiers who represent our history.
Do you feel like writing poetry, particularly as you're thinking about grieving the loss of your mother, do you feel like that's a – it sounds like that's another kind of comfort. You know, there's the cold comfort of the stone, but I imagine there's a lot more warmth in the metaphor or the writing the memory.
Yeah, the poem – a poem is a sacred and living language. And so in poems, she lives again in ways that she doesn't in the actual world.
And so for you, do you feel like that continues to help with – I mean, because I'm – losing a parent, losing a mother is something that is – it's not something that you can get over, right? So I wonder if this is a way that this helps you continue to grieve the loss?
I think so. I think that's sort of where I was going. I don't know that I've finally got there with that idea of our metaphors going on ahead of us. You know, I tend to look outward in order to avoid a kind of navel gazing that, of course, any of us would want to do. But is there a way to do it while also looking out at the world? And so I still feel like my historical topics choose me. But what happens is they always reveal to me the deeper metaphor, the deeper thing. And so even when I'm writing about various historical characters and historical subjects, something always in there is about that loss that I live with constantly.
It's also, in a way, though, as we're talking about loss, it's about a loss we all have as Americans and not hearing these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you sort of see that loss play out. What's sort of the result of that collective memory loss in our country today?
That collective amnesia, that memory loss, is very dangerous because often you find a complete lack of awareness. You were talking about it earlier on, the things that we're not taught in school. And our own inner lives are starved because of that. And it threatens to damage our interactions between each other. When you see incidents of what my colleague Carol Anderson would call white rage, it often is predicated on a lot of history that has been buried that people don't know about. I feel like if people knew certain things about history, they wouldn't make the kinds of racist assumptions that they make. For example, one might be, well, you know, my people came here as immigrants. Why can't these people, meaning Black people, for example, get themselves together? Why can't they do what my white ancestors did? And often, if they actually knew the history and how different the history was for some groups of people versus other groups of people, they might not think that. And we might instead know how much more we are alike as Americans without focusing all the time on how different we seem to be.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Natasha Trethewey, the poet. We're talking about poetry, about American history, about America today. And we're going to talk about that when we come back. Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. I'm I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st, and my guest is Natasha Trethewey, a former poet laureate of the United States. We're speaking with her about her poetry, her work. Your father, Eric Trethewey, was also a poet. He passed away in 2014, I believe. Before his death, you had already written, we've been talking about elegies, you had already written one for him. Mm-hmm. Why did you do that?
Well, it's a very different kind of elegy. It's, you know, generally, of course, the elegy is to remember someone who's passed. But this is a poem that elegizes something else that's lost. And so it was a very difficult poem to write, but it was a poem that I had to write in order to communicate something deeply painful with my beloved father in the only language he would really listen to, and that's the language of poetry.
And what was his response when he read it?
He loved the poem, but I think he also was a bit in denial about what I was elegizing to. And instead, he said how lucky he was to get to see a beautiful elegy before he was gone. And so that means he was sort of overlooking the other thing that we'd lost that the poem is also trying to deal with. He also, you know, remarked that the poem made him look like less than an excellent fisherman. So that bothered him a little bit, too. But it's all true. He did not catch a fish that day.
I wonder if we could, if you would mind reading another poem about your father. This is Enlightenment, and your father, Canadian. I think it's such a fascinating. Your father, a Canadian, as we've been talking about. You all standing in front of a portrait of Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that?
Yes, sure. This is perhaps the hardest poem I ever had to write for my fourth collection. It's a poem that tries to examine the kind of deeply ingrained and often unexamined notions of racial difference that are manifest in the society at large, but even in the intimate relations within families, as with my beloved white father. Enlightenment. In the portrait of Jefferson that hangs at Monticello, he is rendered two-toned, his forehead white with illumination, a lit bulb, the rest of his face in shadow, darkened as if the artist meant to contrast his bright knowledge, its dark subtext. By 1805, when Jefferson sat for the portrait, he was already linked to an affair with his slave. Against a backdrop blue and ethereal, a wash of paint that seems to hold him in relief, Jefferson gazes out across the centuries, his lips fixed as if he's just uttered some final word. The first time I saw the painting, I listened as my father explained the contradictions, how Jefferson hated slavery, though, out of necessity, my father said, had to own slaves, that his moral philosophy meant he could not have fathered those children, would have been impossible, my father said. For years, we debated the distance between word and deed. I'd follow my father from book to book, gathering citations, listen as he named, like a field guide to Virginia, each flower and tree and bird, as if to prove a man's pursuit of knowledge is greater than his shortcomings, the limits of his vision. I did not know then the subtext of our story, that my father could imagine Jefferson's words made flesh in my flesh, the improvement of the blacks in body and mind in the first instance of their mixture with the whites, or that my father could believe he'd made me better. When I think of this now, I see how the past holds us captive, its beautiful ruin etched on the mind's eye, my young father, a rough outline of the old man he's become, needing to show me the better measure of his heart, an equation writ large at Monticello. That was years ago. Now we take in how much has changed. Talk of Sally Hemings, someone asking, How white was she? Parsing the fractions as if to name what made her worthy of Jefferson's attentions. A near-white quadroon mistress, not a plain black slave. Imagine stepping back into the past, our guide tells us then, and I can't resist whispering to my father, this is where we split up. I'll head around to the back. When he laughs, I know he's grateful I've made a joke of it, this history that links us, white father, black daughter, even as it renders us other to each other.
That's Enlightenment by Natasha Trethewey, who's here with me. That's from Thrall, her most recently published work. She published that in 2012. I mean, as you listen to that, I can't, as you said, it was, I mean, it's very clear to understand why that was such a difficult thing for you to write. And I read, do you write everything? You write out your poems by hand?
I do.
And then, so that's sort of, you draft out by hand?
Yeah, I spend several drafts handwritten long before I ever go to the computer and begin to sort of move things around. It's a whole different drafting process when I move from handwriting to typing it out.
And may I ask how many handwriting drafts did Enlightenment take?
Oh, my goodness. Enlightenment took a lot of drafts. I don't know exactly how many handwritten drafts, but after I typed it in the first time, then I'll print out the drafts as I work on them, and I handwrite on them the changes and the scratching out and all that. So, you know, I have a stack probably at least that thick, an inch thick.
And then you save all of them, right?
Yeah,
do you save
all of them.
Good. Okay. Wow. You know, there's so much in that, in Enlightenment. There's so much to discuss. But I wonder if I can just ask you about the South and our understanding of the South, mm-hmm. Outside of the, you know, outside of not, and I don't even mean Southern history, I even mean today. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you think we have at all done an adequate job in this country of sort of understanding each other's regional pasts and histories.
Well, one of the things it seems to me, being a native Southerner and traveling outside of the out of the South, is the ways in which the stereotypes about the South seem to hang on. There are so many ways that any Southerner, black or white, is bound to get defensive about the South because we're often, you know, portrayed as, you know, backwards and slow. And I mean, you know, the list of stereotypes go on. I'm sure your audience knows more than I even know, coming from the place. But I think what gets missed is the complexity of a place like the South, and particularly my home state, Mississippi. You know, my relationship with the South is the I think the only kind one can really have if you're a thoughtful person, and that is a love-hate relationship. There's plenty to hate about my South, but it's also my native land. And so I love it. Loving it means trying to make it better. And of course, that is the most patriotic of acts, trying to make better the thing that you love.
Would you say that's probably true of, I would think, and I agree with you about the South. You know, I was telling you before we went on air, I didn't realize when you grew up in Florida, when you grew up in South Florida, you don't realize how Southern you are until you leave. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of realized the parts of my upbringing and my identity that were very Southern, mm-hmm. when I moved here to the Midwest. But do you think that probably most Americans have a sense of, if they are thoughtful about this country, have sort of a love-hate relationship, no matter, I don't know if you feel like in the South, you're making a face, you don't think that they do.
Well, that's why I said, you know, the thing I said before about the most patriotic of acts is to, you know, have that kind of love-hate relationship and to try to make a place better. There are plenty of people, I think, who sadly think any criticism of the South or the United States is unpatriotic. And it seems to me that those are the people that unquestionably love or are patriotic about the nation without also being able to talk about its flaws and all the things we need to fix.
Well, it's fascinating you say this. I was just watching a news report last week about Confederate monuments mm-hmm. and sort of the movement. And this has been a big issue in New Orleans mm-hmm. With the mayor wanting to remove monuments. And it sounds exactly like what you're saying. People who say we don't want to remove these monuments because, well, they're just part of our history. And we need to, you know, we need to have, it's okay to have a monument to Jefferson Davis because this is part of our history. And it doesn't mean, you know.
Well, I think the danger of removing monuments is not telling the full version of the story. We need to contextualize those monuments. You know, if you need to move them from a certain place, okay, put them over here, but put them with plaques that tell exactly why they were erected and what they mean. You know, monuments are doing different kinds of work. There are some monuments that were erected just, say, in the 19th century or at a different moment when the thinking in the nation was one way. Then there are monuments that were erected specifically as a response to the civil rights movement or, you know, the attempt to get equal rights for all of American citizens. Those are monuments that are meant to be in direct response, such as the Confederate flag in the state of Georgia. That's a flag that does not go back to the end of the Civil War, the one that we had that was so contested. It was one that was erected in direct response to Brown v. Board of Education. It was a message to African Americans.
There's so much of your work we haven't talked about. I'm thinking of Hurricane Katrina and all of that. As we're just about out of time, I did want to ask you, though, about do you have a hope of what you think people will take away from your poetry, from your writing, particularly if they're American?
My goal is always to tell a fuller version of our story as Americans, not to erase one history in favor of another, not to look at them as two trains running on separate tracks, but to see how intertwined our stories are and how, in knowing our stories, we can continue the work to be the best nation that we can be, moving toward fulfilling the tenets of our Constitution.
I can't help but think, as you say this, of how much we've talked about in the past 9 months, in the past year, how divided we are as a country, how we don't how many parts of the country, whether it's rural or urban or southern or not, we don't understand each other. Do you think it's because we're not taking the time to try to understand that context, to hear these stories? Do you think it's a deeper problem?
I think it is hard to hear each other. It's hard because so much of our day-to-day language is the language of sound bites, cliches, the rise of uncivil discourse. And this is when I, you know, have to turn back to poetry again and again, because poetry does ask for us to slow down a little bit. It also, it's the one way we have of reaching not only the intellect, but also the heart. It asks us to be more thoughtful, more empathetic. It asks us to see the world through a lens, an intimate lens, of someone else, their voice speaking to us across the distances. That's a way that I think we hear each other. And I can say it even now that, you know, some of the things that I say may sound incendiary to someone, but it's very different if you hear it in a poem. Because that is, you know, the intimate nature of the soul trying to communicate with someone else's soul.
It's really another language.
It is another language. But it's one that I think can save us.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, to talk to us about your poetry, to read some of it. Natasha Trethewey, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news.
Search for our Facebook page, Like the 21st. You can comment there, too, on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Bob Holly and Alan Montecelio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance of the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.